From West Babylon, New York, this is Sports Talk 1240.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. I'm Bill Donahue. I'll be taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 16th day of April, Easter Sunday. Happy Easter to all those celebrating out there. Our engineer is with us, of course, Brian Graves. He's just across the way taking care of business. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight. Once again, it's book season, and up first we'll welcome in author Paul Dixon, and we'll discuss his new book, Leo DeRocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son. In the second half, we'll welcome in former professional pitcher Isla Borders. She'll join us, and we'll talk about her new book, Making My Pitch, A Woman's Baseball Odyssey. So sit back and relax. Enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on GBB. We've got some great stuff ahead for you in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page called Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, then you can give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at Sports Talk 1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. Well, my first guest has written over 65 books and hundreds of newspaper and magazine articles about baseball, the American language, and 20th century history. Among other awards, his bio of Bill Veeck, baseball's greatest maverick. He was on the show a few years ago. We discussed that work. It won the 2013 Casey Award for Best Baseball Book of the Year. In 2010, the Dixon Baseball Dictionary was named one of the five best baseball books ever written by the Wall Street Journal. His new book is titled Leo DeRocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son. I'd like to welcome to the show tonight Paul Dixon. Paul, good evening.
Bill, great to be here.
Great to have you with us, Paul. Tremendous job on the Leo DeRocher book, by the way. A great read. Folks should definitely check that out. What I'd like to talk about first, Paul, is a topic that I find intriguing with Leo DeRocher. He was on the Yankees in the 20s. Nicknamed the All-American Out by Babe Ruth. Let's talk about Leo's relationship with the Babe.
Well, it got off to a bad start. Leo really, through all of his life, he was disdainful of anybody who had a larger share of the spotlight than he did. And in his first year when he comes up with the Yankees, comes up in 25, spends 2 years in the minors in Atlanta and St. Paul. But then when he comes up full bore with the Yankees, starts the season with them, he immediately alienates not only Babe Ruth, but Ty Cobb. Because Cobb is now in the twilight of his career playing in Philadelphia. And DeRocher goes out of his way to insult Cobb. But he immediately latched on to Ruth and decided he was stupid and called him dummy. And the relationship went downhill. At one point in the 28th season, Babe Ruth was convinced that Leo had stolen his watch.
Right.
And that goes on for, you know, the last time Ruth appears anywhere, he's at Yankee Stadium when he's dying, and he turns to Happy Chandler, who's then the commissioner. He said, you know, the one guy I'll never forgive is DeRocher, who stole my watch. It may or may not be true, but it sort of colored that whole relationship. But the thing that was interesting about DeRocher on the Yankees, he alienated the other players to the point where in 28, they were actually throwing balls on purpose to him so that he couldn't make a double play. They were overthrowing him. They were underthrowing him. They were doing everything they could to sabotage him. Hmm. This is how sort of great the enmity that he built between himself and the players like Gehrig and the rest of the Murderers Row Yankees.
Well, one person he didn't alienate, Paul, was Miller Huggins, was it?
It's this really interesting thing because the reason I call the book The Prodigal Son, every place he lands and can end up being pretty much destroyed by the system and by his own arrogance and his own impulsiveness, he ends up with a father figure, somebody who was going to protect him. And the first guy is Miller Huggins, who's protecting him. Huggins thinks that DeRocher has more hustle, more game face, more whatever the adjective you want to use, than almost anybody else on the team. And he, at one point, he actually talks about rebuilding the team. He goes to Arthur Mann, this journalist, and says, I want to rebuild the Yankees. This is the 28 Yankees around DeRocher and a couple other guys
Oh boy.
He thought were really hustling.
Yeah.
But so it was a very strange relationship.
Definitely. Now, as we said, his demeanor did not endear himself to the Yankee ownership either. And Hall of Famer Ed Barrow was annoyed by Leo as well, because he didn't like his habit of passing bad checks and his taste in nightlife and clothes, correct?
Yeah, no, he went to the limits, and he was gambling heavily. He was running up gambling debts. He was a pool hole guy. He did a lot of, you know, pool hustling. But he was also running up debts for, he would go to Dunhill's, which is the, you know, the most, probably the most famous haberdasher in the world and on Fifth Avenue, and buy cravats. And you know, he'd show up in a hotel lobby with a cane and spats. I mean, he thought he was Maurice Chevalier or something. You know? And the other players, these other guys, a lot of them, you know, Southern guys out of small towns, and they looked at this guy and they hated him. I mean, he was like something from another planet.
Leo the Lip. Yeah, for sure. Now, he helped the team win the World Series in 28, but then he demands a raise, so he finally wears out his welcome in New York, and they sell him to the Cincinnati Reds.
Which, at that point in history, to change leagues was beyond belief. I knew they were two separate enterprises, and once you were traded to the other league, it was the assumption was you'd really been a problem. And Rocher felt later in his life that Ruth had put the word around the league not to take him. Ruth and a couple of Yankees said, get this guy out of the American League. We don't want him.
Amazing. I was speaking with Paul Dixon tonight, whose new book is about Leo DeRocher. After some years with the Reds, he's traded to the Cardinals. And the rumor has it, Paul, that he was the inspiration for the term Gas House Gang.
Yeah, I mean, there's some dispute about that. He claims it referenced the gas house. It was on the Connecticut River in Springfield, Mass., where Leo is from.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that on that team, he becomes the epitome of that team. You know, brawling, dirty uniforms, cheating with great pride. I mean, one of the things, the rest of his life, DeRocher would talk about how he would handle the ball for Dizzy Dean, and at shortstop, he'd get the ball and walk it back to Dean, and as he went back, he would cut the ball on the upper side of his belt buckle, which was sharpened like a knife, and gouge the ball so that Dean could get this amazing pitch, that, you know, a dipsy doodle kind of pitch out of it, because it was so defaced. But in both places, Cincinnati and in St. Louis, he ends up with another benefactor. And in Cincinnati, it's a guy named Sidney Weil who protects him, who, you know, helps him pay off his debts. And then when he gets to St. Louis, it's Branch Rickey. The interesting thing about both these guys, Weil and Rickey, both men were very religious men. Weil was an observant Jew. Rickey was almost a very, very serious Methodist who wouldn't go to baseball games on Sundays. And they both felt, so they had almost this biblical, again, the prodigal son, this almost biblical faith, both men did, that they could save this guy from himself. And, of course, they do. They do. Time and again, they pull his fat out of the fire.
Yeah, exactly. Now, for those folks who may be wondering, Leo had a reputation as a solid fielder but a poor hitter.
Yeah.
He batted .247 with 24 home runs and 567 RBIs during his career. He was named to a couple of All-Star teams, though, Paul, wasn't he?
Yeah, he made the All-Star teams in 36, 38, and 40. And in one of them, he has the distinction of getting a home run bunt. He bunted and made it with the help of an error or two. But he made it from the bunt from home plate to home plate. But he was the thing that really made it, the difference for DeRocher was he was an amazing bench jockey, so he was useful in that regard. But he was an extraordinary fielder. So when he first goes to Hartford as a kid, before the Yankees find him, he's doing plays that nobody can believe. He's taking routine, what appear to be routine singles, and turning them into double plays. He's leaping, he's moving, his range of sort of play is all over the middle of the infield. And so at the end of the first year in Hartford, he's batting 207. He's got the Cubs, the Cardinals, and the Yankees chasing him. And eventually the Yankees sign him. But everybody wanted this guy for his defense. And so that's what made the difference. That's what kept him a really hot commodity in the game.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now, folks may not know that Leo, when he was traded to Brooklyn finally, made history of a sort by making the final out in Johnny Vandermeer's second consecutive no-hitter.
Absolutely, and that's DeRocher seems to be like Zelig. You know, he ends up in places where you won't believe it. I mean, he's of course there for the he's managing the Giants with the Bobby Thompson home run. He's there for the bringing up of Jackie Robinson. He's there for one thing after another, big games, and the Vandermeer thing is just a classic example of DeRocher being there for the moment.
In the right place at the right time, definitely. Now, Brooklyn's starting shortstop during his first year, Larry McPhail, another Hall of Famer, is a general manager in Brooklyn. Very volatile relationship there as well, right, Paul?
Yeah, they McPhail fires him time and time again.
Yeah,
it has to do one time it'll be gambling. I mean, DeRocher is not comporting himself well. I mean, he beats up a caddy in spring training. He gets caught gambling in spring training, so it's not like he's not the ideal citizen. And he's getting and McPhail, of course, loses his temper and fires him, and the next morning rehires him or doesn't say anything. He just shows up again. But it's an extremely volatile relationship. Two of probably the most volatile personalities in baseball history, and they're under the same roof. And of course, then you know, it's one point to bring in more crowds to the Dodgers in 1939, they bring in Babe Ruth, and again the feud between Ruth and DeRocher kicks in again. And what DeRocher brings to Brooklyn, which is always sort of not really in the game. I mean, it's a good team, it's an interesting team, but DeRocher captivates Brooklyn like nothing you can imagine. And so, you know, I mean, he had this great sense of humor, this great ability to appeal to the people of Brooklyn. He appealed to the fact that the people in Brooklyn consider themselves one of the major cities in America, and they were disdainful of Manhattan, which had gobbled them up. They were a city unto themselves. And even when DeRocher arrives, somebody says, they look at him and they say, "Leo, are you Jewish?" And he says, no, but DeRocher rhymes with kosher. It was that ability. The people in Brooklyn loved him because he was so, the same reason they loved Red Barber. He became their voice.
Yeah.
And it was always, in those days, it considered itself, you know, it was the home of great comedians, and it was the home of this, but it was also, it always felt itself to be sort of, you know, overpowered by the shadow of Manhattan and the skyscrapers and the business interest in New York and such.
He valued the same traits as his and his players, too, Paul. Paul Dixon with us tonight, author of the new book on Leo DeRocher. And he comes up with, I believe he was misquoted at first, "nice guys finish last," talking about, look at Mel Ott over there. He's a nice guy, finishes second. But take a look at the brat, Eddie Stanky. He can't hit, he can't run, he can't field. He's not a nice guy, but the little SOB wins all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. And he says, at the end, he said, "finish last." You know, there was sort of, it's a long column in the New York World Telegram. But the funny thing was, at first he, as people compress it, "the nice guys finish last," at first DeRocher doesn't have any part of it. And then he got to realize it's one of the great lines, and it's going to go in Bartlett's quotations, and it's going to make him, you know, it's a famous line, so then he grabs it. But he did. He had this ability. You know, he never made it to high school. He was never trained in any sense of the word. But he had this extraordinary facility with language and an extraordinary facility with humor and timing. So he learns a lot when he goes during World War II. He goes, travels to army bases and such with Danny Kaye,
right,
the comedian. But he picks up this amazing, you know, as an after-dinner speaker, he can put people on the floor laughing. And it's an extraordinary ability. I mean, he becomes a show business figure after a while, but I've never figured it out. Where did he learn this? Did he just have this, you know, maybe he's like a poet that never went to high school that, you know, has this ability to charm people with what they say.
Charismatic.
Yeah.
Definitely, yeah. Now, as we said, Paul, Larry McPhail leaves the Dodgers. For all things, he joins the Army. And Branch Rickey steps in, and he keeps Leo as the skipper.
And it's under duress because they've known each other for a long time, and when Branch Rickey gets to Brooklyn, the clubhouse and the dugout are infested with gamblers and bookies, and the team is betting heavily. Pitchers are coming off the mound in the third or fourth inning, and talking to a bookie in the dugout and telling him to play $50 on some horse at Hialeah. And when Rickey comes, he said, "We got to clean this place out. It's putting tremendous pressure on this team." And they do. They get it cleaned out, and finally, Rickey takes them back. But it's a real mess when he gets there.
It sure is. And commissioner at the time was A.B. Happy Chandler. And Happy was not with Leo. He, as you said, they were consorting. He was consorting with people like George Raft, Bugsy Siegel.
Yep.
And Leo's having an affair with Lorraine Day. And finally, Happy Chandler has enough, and he suspends him for the year in 1947.
Yeah, and there's a lot of speculation about what really happened there. What was the straw that broke the camel's back? And I did a lot of research on this. One of the things was Chandler hated DeRocher from the beginning. And it goes way back to when DeRocher was in Cincinnati. Chandler had been governor of Kentucky, and he had his eye on DeRocher, mm-hmm. who came across the river from Cincinnati to the big gambling dens in northern Kentucky. And Chandler learned very early on that DeRocher, when he was playing for the Reds, making good a salary, brought his mother to Cincinnati to be a chambermaid in a hotel. And Chandler thought that was the worst thing, imaginable thing he could do. Instead of buying his mother a new house, he gets her a job, you know, menial job in a hotel. And by this time, she's quite old. And they didn't like each other, but the final straw in a meeting with Branch Rickey and the other Dodger brass, Walter O'Malley, Chandler pulls a letter out of his pocket and says, "There's pressure from Washington to get him out of baseball." Puts the letter back in his pocket. Everybody for decades assumed the letter was from J. Edgar Hoover. It was actually from Frank Murphy, who was a justice of the Supreme Court. Very liberal, a very devout Roman Catholic, who felt that DeRocher was a bad influence on the youth of America and was getting some pressure from the Catholic Church in Long Island and Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
That DeRocher had, who was Catholic himself, now is on his third marriage, and they just thought he was a bad moral example for the young people.
Definitely. Now, talking about DeRocher and George Raft and that situation, and Happy Chandler suspending him, there was a rumor that there was an active ball player that was involved in a rigged crap game between George Raft, Leo DeRocher, and the ball player. And it never really came to light who that ball player was. Now, Eldon Auker, Detroit Tigers pitcher, wrote in his biography that it was Detroit pitcher Dizzy Trout.
Yeah. I looked at that from every which way. I couldn't substantiate that, but I can, what was absolutely true, and the district attorney was involved, everybody, they were running crap games out of DeRocher's apartment, and Raft actually got one guy he claimed $18,000 in what he claimed to be an illegal crap game. but it was shady business. And DeRocher, he hung around with these guys that were bookies and bootleggers, guys like Memphis Engelberg and Connie Immerman. But they weren't Murder Incorporated guys. They weren't guys like Siegel and the big time, you know, guys that would whack you in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
But through Raft they were. I mean, sort of, you know, he was always with the wrong guys. And he and Raft were like brothers. They actually went to the same tailor. They dressed alike, including a black knit tie, a black suit.
Right.
You know, the whole deal. So.
Well, one thing that Leo is credited with, Paul, is his role in Erasing Baseball's color line. He let it be known that he wouldn't tolerate dissent of his players who opposed Jackie Robinson joining the club. He said, "I don't care if the guy's yellow, black, if he has stripes like a zebra. If I say he plays, he's going to play."
That was, you know, Leo's probably his greatest positive characteristic was his, he wasn't colorblind, but he was awful close to it. And part of what had happened with Leo when he was very young and was coming, was worked in a factory with a black man named David Redd, spelled R-E-D-D. David Redd was a very fine friend of Leo's and kept pushing him to go to Hartford to try it for the team. And Leo kept saying, "I'm not that good. I can't hit that well." And Redd kept saying, "No, you're a superior ball player. You got to go pushes. Finally gets him to go, and of course the rest is history. But Leo, the rest of Leo's life, he takes care of David Redd. If he's in the World Series, David Redd gets a car and World Series tickets. You know, so he begins this life in a very special way. But as early as 1939, when he's player manager in Brooklyn, he says to a reporter from the Daily Worker, which is the old communist newspaper, he said, "The powers that be in baseball won't let me sign players from the Negro Leagues or some of the dark-skinned men from Cuba." And that finally caught up with him. Landis actually made him retract his statement, which he did with a wink of his eye. But he was pushing so that when Robinson comes up, he's totally on board for that.
And finally, the friction with Branch Rickey boils over. He gets out of his contract with the Brooklyn Dodgers, goes up to Manhattan and works for Horace Stoneham and the Giants. But even guys like Willie Mays, Monty Irvin, they all love the guy too.
Well, he's transformed. I mean, first of all, I was a kid in New York when he went from Brooklyn to the Giants, and it was like General Grant going down and running the Army of the Confederacy. I mean, nobody could believe it. I mean, the tension between those two teams and their fans. I mean, there were fights in the streets and bars and the grandstands. I mean, it was really a lethal sort of competition. And all of a sudden, he goes overnight from one to the other. When he gets to the Giants, he realizes that his way of managing has been sort of to berate the players, to insult them. And what really, I think, changes him, even though it's not permanent, but for the moment, in July 8th, 49, he gets two guys, Henry Thompson and Monty Irvin. Both are African-American men. Henry Thompson has been in the Battle of the Bulge. Monty Irvin's been in the D-Day landing. And Leo understands these are not kids. These are combat veterans who are not going to take any crap from him. They're not going to be pushed around. They're, and he realizes he's got to give them this level of respect. And that sort of permeates the team. He's starting to talk to the players like equals, like men he has deep respect for. All of a sudden, a year later, he gets Willie Mays, who's from a sheltered, very small-town environment, not sure of himself. And Leo then rises to the occasion and literally takes over Willie Mays and says, "Look, you can have any slump you want. You're going to be one of the greatest players ever," and gives him every level of confidence that he can. And of course, at the end of his life, Willie Mays is the only player to speak at Leo DeRocher's funeral. But those guys loved him. The Giants loved him. He learned to treat players differently there. And of course, they did everything they could for him, and that included, you know, that miracle team with the miracle of Coogan's Bluff and the Bobby Thompson home run and the rest of it.
Sure, yeah. He finally got his revenge on the Brooklyn Dodgers that day, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
Now, Leo in Hollywood is something I remember when I was growing up, Paul. Leo on the Munsters with Herman hitting the ball five miles. Elroy Crazy Legs Hirsch also appears in that episode. There's the Beverly Hillbillies and, of course, the famous Mr. Ed sliding into home plate.
Absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, when he leaves the Giants, he is paid $75,000 a year by NBC. He is right in the middle of show business. He's befriended his best friend was Frank Sinatra by that time. NBC hires him so he can get Sinatra to show up on the Donna Reed show. He knows everybody in Hollywood by now. And so it's amazing. They actually, at one point, they put Leo up in the Colgate Comedy Hour against Ed Sullivan. And but from that, he does this, all these sitcoms. In fact, if you go, you really look at the movies and the shows he was on with Judy Garland, he was on with What's My Line. He's not only in the sitcoms, he's on every variety show. And, of course, he's in the booth with Lindsay Nelson. He's the first, you know,
right,
player to do Game of the Week.
Uh-huh.
If you owned a black and white television back in the day, you couldn't avoid Leo.
One interesting fact you bring out in the book, Paul, is that he sued Zsa Zsa Gabor once.
Absolutely. And this was typical of Leo. The lawsuit, with the whole battle, Zsa Zsa had said in a car commercial for a transmission, "Tell him Leo sent you." And it was a gag. She was, because every American knew who Leo was. Leo then decides to sue Zsa Zsa for $1 million, which is settled out of court. But the whole battle is done on the Johnny Carson show. I mean, it's not really. It's like there's no court involved. It's Johnny Carson and Leo to be on one night and Zsa Zsa be on the next night, and then Tiny Tim on the next night discussing a case. I mean, it was. You know, I try to tell people this isn't just a baseball book. This is a book about 20th century celebrity. You know, this is a book about a guy who takes his legal battles on it with Johnny Carson.
Exactly. Now, he's posthumously voted into the Hall of Fame. I believe it was 94. But as you say, Paul, it's a book about more than baseball, and it should be read by every baseball fan. It's been a pleasure. We could go on and on with Leo DeRocher. This is one topic, folks, that's almost inexhaustible. It's been a pleasure speaking with you tonight, Paul. I thank you for taking part out of your Easter Sunday night to be with us.
Well, this has been great fun. I really appreciate the time.
Once again, folks, the book is called Leo DeRocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son. It's by Paul Dixon. It's available on Amazon and anywhere that you shop for books. And I thank you once again, Paul.
I really do appreciate this evening.
All the best. Paul Dixon, folks. Up next, we'll talk to former pitcher Isla Borders about her new book, Making My Pitch, A Woman's Baseball Odyssey. So stick around, folks.
You are listening to Sports Talk 1240 on Long Island's AM 1240. WGBB.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Want to advertise your business on Sports Talk 1240? Place an ad on sportstalk1240.com and run a radio commercial during the show every Sunday night here on AM 1240 WGBB. Our rates are very affordable. We'll even produce the radio commercial for you. Just head over to sportstalk1240.com and fill out the Contact Us form and let us start promoting your business today.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit Gustbuster.com and get your Gustbuster today.
Stay connected to Sports Talk 1240 by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Sports Talk 1240.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on GBB Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you on this Easter Sunday evening. I hope everybody enjoyed their day, had a nice, restful, warm day here on Long Island in the approach 80 degrees, and not too bad for this time of year. I hope you're enjoying Sports Talk 1240. Very interesting chat with Paul Dixon about his book on Leo DeRocher, a topic, as we said, that's inexhaustible, that could go on for an hour talking about Leo. Baseball season in full swing. The Mets drop a few to the Miami Marlins. Yankees playing the St. Louis Cardinals tonight. The NHL and NBA playoffs are in full swing, and we'll keep our eyes on that. Well, my next guest is the first woman to win a men's professional baseball game. She's been honored twice at the Baseball Hall of Fame and was inducted in 2003 into the Baseball Reliquary Shrine of the Eternals. Her book is entitled Making My Pitch, A Woman's Baseball Odyssey. I'd like to welcome into Sports Talk 1240 tonight Isla Borders. Isla, good evening.
Good evening, Bill.
It's great to have you with us.
Yeah, great to be on. I'm a little jealous, I have to say. 80 degrees out there. That sounds fantastic.
Oh, yeah, that was not usual, though. It should be in the 50s and 60s, so we were very lucky today.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about your early days in Little League, middle school, high school, Isla. Who were your favorite players, role models, teams, anybody?
Oh, goodness. I would say, obviously, my dad, you know, played for the Dodgers in the minor league system. And then growing up in L.A., I watched the Dodgers. Mm-hmm. But 1985, when George Brett, Brett Saberhagen, and Oral Hershiser, those were the three that I really watched. I don't know what it was, just my age or something, but those were the people that I always followed when I was younger.
Excellent. Okay, yeah. Saberhagen used to live down the block from here when he was with the Mets.
Oh, yeah. I did not know that. Yeah. I think 85 it was when they won the entire World Series. I just remember that vividly.
Great year, definitely. Now, you were the first woman to be awarded a baseball scholarship. Talk a little bit about that for us.
It wasn't easy. I kind of talk about it in my book. What it talks about is, you know, I put out, feelers to 25 or like 23 colleges. And I just put a portfolio together, kind of what the kids do now. And I wanted to see who was interested. I wanted to go somewhere where I wanted to get be seen. You know, I wanted to play Major League Baseball, so I wanted to go to a school that was competitive. I know scouts were going to be there. I wanted a coach that wanted me there. And I had three schools come back to me and say, hey, we're open to you playing. You know, you have good stats. We'll give you a scholarship. And then Charlie Phillips came out, and he scouted me when I was in high school. And he was a left-handed pitcher for USC under Dado. And he kind of just said, hey, you know, we have tons of guys that are getting signed out of college. You're going to get seen. I'm a left-handed pitcher. I can teach you a lot. You're still in Southern California. And then NAIA, it's kind of like Division II, but they have less rules than Division I. Mm-hmm. So the nice thing is it's almost like you're playing year-round. We played against Cal State Fullerton. We played against a lot of Division I schools in our off season, and then we would play our Division II schools during the season. So it worked out perfectly. I got a scholarship to go there, and pretty much baseball paid for my bachelor's degree. But it wasn't easy, but that's how it went about.
Outstanding. All right. Now, you became one of the first female pitchers in integrated men's professional baseball. Found out there was a young lady by the name of Toni Stone who had played in the Negro Leagues. And in 97, you signed with the St. Paul Saints of the Northern League. Now, we know Mike Vec was there. Did you think, Isla, that this was just, Mike Vec, folks, is Bill Vec's son, and they never met a promotion or kind of a gig go by that, that they didn't like. Did you feel it was a publicity stunt by Mike Vec?
I didn't, and this is the reason why.
Okay.
Is one, the Northern League is just known as a very remarkable league. It kind of goes down as like high A ball pitching and double A hitting. And they, at the time that I signed, they already had their season completely sold out for this year, 97 and 98. So I was like, this is going to be perfect, because if I do sign to go there, nobody could say I was picked up to sell tickets, because they've already sold out every single game for the next 2 years.
Great point.
And
yeah.
So that's why I was like, if somebody says that, it's actually not true if they look at it, because it's completely sold out for 2 years. I think what is Mike was ahead of his time.
Yeah.
And you're right, he does have some promotions. He believes, you know, fun is good. But he's also a very open man, and he believed in me. He had a scout come out, Barry Moss, and look at me. And he's like, you know, if Barry doesn't come back with a good report, then we're not going to sign you. And then when I went to St. Paul to be with Mike Vec, I didn't have a contract. He's like, we're not paying for you to come out here, but you could come out May 15th. You have 2 weeks to make the team and to convince Marty Scott and Barry Moss to hire you on the team. And, you know, you have 22 people coming into camp, and we take, I don't know, 12. And he's like, you've got to make that cut. He goes, I'll give you the opportunity, but you have to prove to them. And then I was very lucky at that time, and I was able to make the team. I just had somebody that gave me the opportunity, which was Mike Vec.
Mm-hmm. We've had Mike on the show, by the way. Very interesting man. Very good for baseball, I would say, as was his Hall of Fame father. You made your first regular season game May 31st, 1997. Do you remember that, Isla?
I remember good and bad.
Okay.
It's kind of like my life. The first time I go, it kind of messes up, and then the second time I come through. But nobody knows exactly kind of what happened, except for the people that was there. And I came into the game with one out, and I made a pitch, and I got a ground ball, got a double play, and everybody was going into the dugout. And then I was just like, oh, thank God. And they called a balk on me. And from that point on, it just spiraled downhill. It was horrible. I think I hit a person. I got pulled. It was just really, really bad. And when I was leaving, Marty Scott and Barry Moss, they both came up to me, and they're like, hey, we believe in you, but you're going to come back out tomorrow. We're playing tomorrow. And they're like, the only thing that you could do to get over this is by coming right back out and getting right back in it. You can't sit on this. So he goes, you're going to be pitching tomorrow. Go in, shake it off, and come back tomorrow. And then I came back the following day, and they put me back in, and then I struck out the side. So, like I said, I was surrounded by very knowledgeable baseball men, and they really helped my career.
Sure did. Get right back up on that horse.
Yeah.
1 month into the season, Isla, you're traded to the Duluth Superior Dukes. Why did they do that?
I think they wanted to, the Dukes weren't doing so well at that time, and I was going to get more innings in, and the Dukes needed pitching. And St. Paul, you know, I think they really believed in me, and they wanted me to get some more innings. I'm a rookie, and it's really hard. I mean, my main goal my first year was just to survive the league. It's extremely intense. We went through, oh my gosh, 15 rookies the first year.
Wow.
So that's what I try to tell people. I'm like, don't compare me to, like Kershaw or these standout pitchers. You know, compare me to another rookie that just went into Northern League, and I held my own. And that was my main goal the first year, and it worked out to where, you know, I went with the Dukes and was able to be more in a pitcher's ballpark and fit together really well on that team. We really meshed and learned a lot. From Mike Cuellar was my pitching coach.
Oh, yeah.
And I was lucky to win the entire, be on the part of the team of the Northern League Championship.
Wonderful. Well, we're speaking to Isla Borders tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Her new book is called Making My Pitch, A Woman's Baseball Odyssey. Now, do you remember the first game that you won, Isla?
I don't. That's why
I'm
the book.
Oh, okay.
I don't write about it. I write about my second game that I actually was up ahead 2-0, and I ended up getting the no decision. The the first game was kind of a blur to me.
The first game was July 24th, 98. Mm-hmm. As I said, you won that ball game. It was a 3-1 victory against the Sioux Falls Canaries.
Mm-hmm.
And they took the baseball and the lineup cards and donated them to Cooperstown.
Yeah, like I said, that's fantastic. And I can even talk great things about the Sioux Falls Canaries. You know, Steve Howell was over there at the time, and he said great things about me and was a huge fan and helped me out a lot. Ken Medlock, he was like in Moneyball. He was a pitching coach at the time, good friend of Barry Moss, and, you know, he helped me out. So there's been, like I said, a lot of great people that I've been able to learn from.
Now, you returned to the Dukes in 99. Mm-hmm. You're working out of the bullpen. You didn't see eye to eye to this guy on your role, though, did you?
No. You know, how do I say this in the correct way? I guess I won't. I'll just say it.
We
did not get along.
Right.
I shouldn't say we didn't get along. He just didn't like me, and that's okay. You know?
Yeah.
He didn't like me because he was on a different team when I was pitching against him, and then he became our manager, and he just didn't want me with there, which was fine. You know, I moved to another team, and then I got to go with the Madison Black Wolf, and then, oh my gosh, I got to work with Dirty Al Gallagher as my manager.
I remember him when I was a kid, on the San Francisco Giants. Never washed his uniform, folks.
Oh, he never did when I was there.
Oh, no?
Oh, my gosh, we would give him a hard time. You know, great man, but he always smelled like onions.
Dirty Al, yeah.
Yeah.
One of the characters in baseball. Now, as you go to the Madison Black Wolf. That's a great name. You post the best numbers of your career, and they make you a three-inning starter.
That was just at the beginning. They wanted me to start going five. How it worked out is we had a middle reliever that wanted to go. That was Dirty Al's plan, and then we wanted to start going five. But, I don't know how to really say that, except that was his plan at that time.
Okay. Yeah, and you also sustained an injury that year. You were on the DL for a while.
With Madison?
Yes. Weren't you?
No, a wrist
injury.
No, I just missed one game.
Okay.
No, I didn't get hurt. The problem that I got hurt is I had surgery on the back of my neck after I went 12 scoreless innings. That was when I was with Duluth, and then I had to get surgery on my neck.
Okay. Not bad.
But no DL.
Yeah, all right. Now, some of the obstacles that you faced, Isla, in your journey, learning to fit in with teammates. You had wives and girlfriends wondering what you were doing there. You had to work with the media, fend off groupies. Talk a little bit about those situations.
Oh, my goodness. I can talk for ages about that. Let's see, where can I... You know, what I try to do is I try to think of, if I was a guy and I heard of a girl coming in, what would be my concerns? And how can I help? Now, this was obviously, 17, 19 years ago, so it's pretty different.
Okay. We lost Isla there. We'll try to get her back. Brian's trying to rectify that situation now. We ready? All right. Sorry about that, Isla. We don't know what happened there.
Yeah, that technology was supposed to get better. I haven't moved.
Yeah. Maybe somebody chopped a wire from here to Oregon. I don't know
what
happened. But we were talking about the obstacles you had to deal with.
Right. And I was trying – I don't even know where I got cut off. I would say what was I even – I'm trying to remember what – question wasn't where I got cut off.
You had to fit in with the teammates, your male teammates.
Oh.
You had the wives and girlfriends up against you, the media, and the groupie situation.
It was trying to think of, if I was a guy, what would I, what would be going through my head? What would I be thinking? And I wanted to calm their fears. And one was, you know, I'm not going into their locker room to try to switch things up. I'm not going there to try to do an inside scoop. I'm not there to try to pick up guys. I'm not there for any other reason except for I want to play Major League Baseball, too. That's my goal. That's all of our goals there.
Right.
And to help win a championship team and get wins. And it took them some time to see, oh, she's not here just for the media. Oh, she's not here to be the first. This girl actually is a teammate and, you know, wants to work hard and wants to make it to the major leagues and, you know, is helping. I would help out the guys with their pitching or I'd throw batting practice and they would help me. It just took some time to build that relationship, I would say about 1 year. And then they were, you know, my biggest fans and still good friends of mine.
Wonderful. Now, your real goal, Isla, was to get into an organization that was affiliated, correct?
Yes. Yeah. Just at that time.
Fastest track.
It wasn't the correct time.
Yeah. Now, we look back at some of those teams. I believe some of them are affiliated now. The St. Paul Saints are with the American Association. They left the Northern League, so that would have been ideal. But the fastest track is to get with an affiliated organization.
Right. And I had, you know, Marge Schott was trying to do something, the Cincinnati Reds. And I had some other people that were interested. And I thought after that season with the Madison Black Wolf, when I posted good numbers, that's when they're like, okay, you've gone 3 years now in a, you know, pretty much like a high A, double A ball team. And, you know, J.D. Drew is my center fielder. I mean, there's great talent there. Tons of people have gone on to play Major League Baseball from that division or that league. And so they wanted to invite me, but when it got closer, they were just like, oh, my gosh, the media is just going to be insane, and we don't want to take away from the game. We don't want a media hoopla event. And they said, you know, we're not going to invite you. We're just not ready for it. And that just crushed my spirit. I finally got to a point where it's like, okay, even if I post good numbers, even if I do really well, they're just not ready for it.
Yeah, I can see that. Now, one thing I found interesting, Isla, I found it on YouTube, was your appearance with the King of All Media.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Now, no, I've been trying to hide that.
Yeah, I found it, and I just thought it was interesting. Artie Lang, who was Howard's sidekick for a couple of years, you had to strike him out. Is that correct?
Yeah. So it was a big show, like everything is with Howard Stern.
Right.
And I've got to tell you, I became a huge fan of Howard Stern after everything happened there. As far as how it looks disastrous, but behind the scenes, it was really funny. When I showed up there, I met with Howard and his team, and he's like, hey, we're going to say this about you. We're going to do this. We're going to do all this stuff. And I said, hey, I'm fine with it, and I'm going to roll with it. So everything was pretty much planned. The only thing, like when I went out there, they gave me a Little League. You know those sponge baseballs that you give to the Little Leaguers?
Yeah.
He gave me one of those, and I was like, where's my baseball?
Yeah.
And they gave me that. I'm like, I'm not going to be able to throw a strike. He tried to throw the ball, and it's really soft like this and rubbery. It's just going to stick to my fingers.
Yeah.
And I think I almost hit Artie twice. I was like, oh, my God, this is not going to be good. So I finally just threw a little curveball and hung it, and he hit it, and I was like, fantastic, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
But Howard was a class act. He really was. Everybody that was on his team, and I told him from now on, I'm going to be a huge fan of yours.
Yeah, I used to listen to Howard when he was on K-Rock in Manhattan, but I just don't have satellite radio, so I haven't listened to him in years, but I understand he's doing well and thriving as a media mogul and king of all media should. We got Isla Borders with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Her book is entitled Making My Pitch, A Woman's Baseball Odyssey. Now, your style of pitching was, you were more of a control pitcher.
Yeah, I had to be. I'm, you know, 5'9". I'm big for a girl, but not for a guy. So, you know, 5'9", 145. And when I pitched, I even used my toes. And I would throw, the highest I got clocked was 83, like a true 83. Some people say that, but it's like, go to the, get the jugs and get clocked. But I would throw it around 79. I just kind of found that it was better to throw it at 79 and throw off speed. I threw a screwball, a cut fastball, a curveball, and, you know, obviously a two-seam and four-seam fastball. And I would pitch backwards, and then, you know, when I needed to throw it a little bit harder, that 82 would seem a lot faster to somebody, but obviously was still on the slower side.
Yeah, and you also threw a scroogey, didn't you?
Yeah, yep, that was my out pitch, was a screwball, or like I said, I would throw a four-seam fastball inside, and even though it was like 82, 83, you know, throwing a screwball and then curveball and then coming in with a, you know, 82, 83 mile an hour fastball, it made it look a lot faster.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, in the book, you talk about a difficult family life that you had. Mm-hmm. In the adolescence, you struggled with your self-identity. You were a closeted athlete at a Christian college. That had to be very difficult.
Yeah, that's ultimately why I quit playing pro ball. I mean, the biggest reason. One, yeah, I didn't feel like Major League was ready, but I take full responsibility. I could have still played and gotten through it, and I loved the game, so I could have played. But what stopped me was I was a closeted gay athlete, and I thought with all the media, I was going to get exposed, and I would lose my family. I would lose the chance to play baseball. I would lose my friends. I just met Billy Beane yesterday, which was an honor. And he was telling me, you know, he stopped playing ball prematurely, too, because of the same reason.
Right,
and
yeah.
It's hard to explain to somebody who's not, but it's, you're just hiding this huge lie. And you're so afraid that as soon as it's exposed, everything that's important to you is going to be taken away. So you run.
Yeah. Obviously, that's quite understandable. Now, it has to be Isla, too, a lonely existence, I would imagine. You're the only woman on the bus, in the clubhouse, and even on the field.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and then, you know, you can, but I did not tell my parents, you know, what was going on. I didn't want to tell my friends. I wouldn't tell anybody because I was so afraid that anything would get leaked out, and they would say, see, this is what happens when a woman plays men's professional baseball. And, you know, I knew it wasn't just for me, but if there's another female that comes along behind me, you know, that could damage her too. So my thing was just keep your mouth shut. You're playing, you know, the game that you love, and keep going. But if I had it over again, I would have done a couple of things different, but being, you know, 22 years old and young, you know, you still have a lot to learn.
Definitely, yeah. You've achieved self-acceptance in your life now. You have a successful career again, mm-hmm. and you're a goodwill ambassador for the game. How's your life as a paramedic and firefighter?
Oh, it's fantastic. You know, when I was growing up and playing ball, everything was about my dream. And my first love is still baseball. You know, I just got back from working with Major League Baseball and USA Baseball, putting together baseball clinics for girls. I still go out and coach mostly men. That's the first time I've coached women. I've always just coached men. And now I'm able to give back to people, being, you know, a firefighter and paramedic, and I get a lot of joy from that. So married now and in a very happy place, and things are going very well.
Wonderful.
I'm trying to get back into baseball, though, and see if I can, you know, give back to anybody in any way that I can.
I was going to say, how do you want to do that? But you would do anything.
Yeah. I'm looking to do anything. You know, there's kids, there's people. The book is pretty much about getting knocked down and still getting back up, if that's what I had to say to sum it up.
Right. Now, you've met some interesting people that we see in the book. Of course, mm-hmm. Bill Murray, who's in the ownership group with Mike Vec. How was your relationship with Bill?
I didn't see him that much.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, he was, I've seen him a couple of times now, and he's always extremely supportive, and he's friendly, very genuine. He's just a brilliant man, and I'm very lucky to have met him in that type of setting, because just I don't really know him personally, but he's just always been a huge support and very friendly.
And Annie Leibovitz, you did some work with.
I can talk about her forever. She, to me, is a hero to me. When I was very young and impressionable at that time, here comes this strong, independent, talented lady that just exemplified professionalism and so giving. And it just made a huge impact in my life. And I'm so unbelievably grateful that our paths crossed.
Definitely. Now, Isla Bordas, it's been a pleasure having you with us tonight. I thank you for taking the time out of your Easter Sunday evening to be with us. The book is called, again, folks, Making My Pitch, A Woman's Baseball Odyssey, a great read. I think you'll enjoy it. And thanks again, Isla.
Thank you, Bill. Happy Easter to you.
You too. Take care. Isla
Bye-bye.
Bordas, folks. That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Paul Dixon and Isla Bordas, my engineer, Brian Graves, and you for joining us. Stay tuned for hour number two on Sports Talk 1240. I will be back in this chair with you on Sunday, May 7th, with former Yankees PR man and author Marty Appel. Till then, Bill Donahue, wishing you a good evening, folks.
Expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.